Hi, and welcome to How Not to Think, the podcast that gets you to think creatively about different ways of seeing many aspects of life. I'm Dr. Howard Rankin, and I am delighted today to have with me Kim Justice, who has an incredible story to tell. And so we're going to be talking a lot today about misconceptions and conceptions of brain injury and trauma, which we'll find out soon is something that, unfortunately or otherwise, Kim has experienced herself. Welcome. Thank you so much, Kim, for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Rankin. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's great. And you've got a great story. So tell the listeners a little bit about you and your background, and then how you get to be where you are today.
Okay. And you stop me anytime. I'm Wendy.
That's okay.
I was a financial consultant for over 25 years. Right out of college, I went into the financial services industry and was flying high, very successful, doing a great job. 35 is a good time of life, in the best shape, financially, physically, every other way. And January the 9th of 1995 started out to be a normal day. And I had an appointment with a case. This is going to lend itself to divine intervention, if that's something that people believe in, because it's really incredible to me that back in December, I landed the largest case of my career in that 25 years to start January 1st of 1995. And so that was going to ensure my income for the next calendar year in a big way. Increase of my income. So January 9th, I went down. I was going to go down. Actually, I was going to sneak out of work a little early because I was feeling good after the holidays and the big sale, and my head wasn't really in the game to rush back to work on the 9th. And so my plan was to cut out of the office a little bit early and go down and get just a benign piece of paper signed by this new client that I could have mailed and then cut out for the day, tell my assistant I had an appointment and be gone. And my father wound up getting a hold of me, which never happened in the daytime. And I told him I was going downtown to get this paper signed. And he said, "How about if I pick you up and you get your paper signed, and then we stop and have a cappuccino at a place that was about two blocks from my client?" And I said, "Okay, that'd be great." And so that kind of queered my plan, the way I had set things up. But we did go ahead and do that. I went and got the paper signed. I got back in the car. We had driven about a block, and suddenly I got the most sharp pain that reverberated from inside my brain, inside my head. And I hear people describe a ruptured aneurysm, aka hemorrhagic stroke, as the worst headache they've ever had in their life. I take exception to that description, even from other survivors, because I've had some whopper headaches in my life, and this was nothing like that. This was a pain that was sharp, like a bolt of lightning just shooting through your head, the most extreme pain I've ever felt. And I yelped, and when I yelped, I drew in my hands and my legs. Now, if I would have been driving that day, I wouldn't have had control of the car at that point, and it might have played out differently. Because my father happened to be driving, which never happened, he said, "What's wrong?" And I said, and mind you, I never went to the doctor, never had, except for an annual physical, or if I got a cold once a year, you know, call and maybe get an antibiotic. So he knew it was serious when I answered, "I need to go to a hospital." I knew that whatever happened was really bad. And so another coincidence, if you will, is that my dad had gotten his first cell phone for Christmas.
Wow.
So 9 days ahead. Mm-hmm. And he happened to have our family doctor on his phone. And so he called, happened to get a hold of the doctor who met us at the emergency room. And mind you, this doctor had known me just about all of my life. And so he knew I wasn't a hypochondriac and I didn't come into the doctor. I fault him for that and his judgment, because what he did was diagnose me with a muscle spasm in my neck and sent us home with a prescription for a painkiller. And again, it was very fortunate because I had my own home and lived alone at the time. Again, if this would have happened with a friend or on my own, I couldn't have driven. But my dad said, now I knew he was wrong, but this pain from the time it started, it never ended. It was still going on. And so all my mind could think at that time is, okay, he's wrong, but maybe if I take a pain pill, I can at least function enough to think and communicate cogently. So I was going to go with that. So my dad said, why don't you come to our house, my parents' house, to make sure that you're okay, and then we'll take you back home. And over the course of the next 24 hours, nearly immediately after I took that pill, I started violently vomiting. Mm. And that went on for quite a while. And with the pain going on in the head and that going on, that pressure, it made it even worse. And what it was doing was pushing blood, you know, something had ruptured. And with each one of those, you know, it was making it worse. Blood was filling the cavities. So they called the doctor and he said, well, the pain pill's too strong. Just give her half of one next time. Now, in the meantime, I'm just hanging on for my life. I can't think, you know, I'm just trying to survive. My parents are scared and they don't know what to think. They're trying to trust the doctor. So it went on overnight, and when it was morning, things had changed. I was trying to communicate with my mother, and about on every fifth word, okay, I couldn't get it out. Now, she, like, you know, mom who knows you, would sit in front of me like you are, and she would finish my sentences for me and had a look of alarm on her face. I remember that. And I could understand her at that point, but I couldn't communicate very well. And within a very short time, I was looking at her like I'm looking at you, and I couldn't understand her anymore or communicate. Now, at that point, I don't have recollection, but what happened was they knew at that point there was something very wrong and I needed to go to a hospital. They took me, excuse me, to the hospital. They did a CAT scan and immediately saw the rupture. At that point, I was in a coma for the next 11 days. Mm-hmm. And during that 11 days, I had a near-death experience. I also had open brain surgery where they cut a C scar all the way around from here to here, right inside my headline. And they peel back your face, take a saw, take out a section of your skull, and dance around in your brain. So there's really two forms of trauma there. Well, more than that, really, if you want to say psychologically, obviously. But the other two types of trauma are not only the brain injury itself, you know, the rupture that happened, but open brain surgery and somebody dancing around and vacuuming blood out of your brain is also a traumatic brain injury while fixing it. And so another thing that was good is that microneurosurgical techniques were new at that time. And I'm in the Midwest, and I say that we're the last to get everything, whether it's the latest fashion, fad diet, or whatever it is, expert in new medical techniques, that sort of thing, pandemics. And we happened to have a visiting neurosurgeon in town that did that exact surgery, clipping, that I needed. And so he, of course, was delighted to have a candidate such as myself to be able to have a full surgical suite watching my surgery. I always kind of made a joke that I never signed a model release for my brain, and I should have gotten a cut of that training video that they put out about my brain surgery.
Yeah,
but
image rights and everything. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Didn't happen. But in any case, he saved my life. I don't minimize that at all. But I had a couple follow-up visits with him, and I could walk and talk, and appeared to have normal function again. And so he dismissed me after a couple visits, and then he went away. He was a visiting neurosurgeon. Now, obviously, my confidence in my internist was undermined, and I was never going back to him. And so I was really a person who fell through the cracks, because I wasn't going to be able to communicate with any medical professional that had walked through this process with me. And so I did go back to work for quite some time. In my long, I was off for a year. I guess I should not leave that out. I had some therapy and things that I needed to do to get my speech completely back and to be able to walk again. You get very weak, you know, when you've been in a coma and gone through such a thing. Absolutely. So it took about a year, 11 months or so, for me to get back to work. And everybody, including myself, thought, because I looked the same, I must be the same. And so that's what I tried on, was being the same. And fortunately, since I had been in my business for so long, my hardwiring and long-term memory remembered the rote activity that I did every day in my career. And so for almost a decade, I did go back to work. But what happened in the meantime is that Madoff happened and managed care happened, which changed all the rules and brought in all kinds of compliance. And I had noticed before, earlier in that time, that my mind wasn't processing as quickly as it did before. And that I would get what I call full basket syndrome. I used to be able to multitask like a monster, you know, and get all these things done and make plans, you know, for each night of the weekend. I was single at the time. And I noticed I wasn't able to do that, that I would get extremely fatigued and that I would lose my focus. I'd be reading something and find myself reading the same line or blanking out during the reading, the processing slower, sensitivity to light and sound, and a really overwhelmed feeling when I would get that full basket syndrome, too many things coming at me. I wasn't able to multitask anymore. Right. I had to really monofocus hard. And so when things changed in my industry, I knew that I forgot a lot of things in just in my life, appointments, details. But when it really hit me in my career and I wound up needing to leave my career, was I wasn't able to read and retain all of the new knowledge because my short-term memory had been damaged. And so long-term memory didn't play into it anymore. And my short-term memory was toast. So to save my...
Can I just stop you there a second and ask you about your experiences in the coma, if you had any, and explain why I ask you that when you told me whether you recall anything from being in the coma or anything like that?
Well, I experienced a near-death experience in the coma, and what happened was it starts where I see the color green. Picture yourself if you're lying down and somebody put a swath of cloth over your eyes so that that's all you could see. So my first awareness is the color green. And I'm curious about it because the color is so crisp and bright and intense, like nothing I had ever seen before in my lifetime. And I could liken it a little bit to like when you take off your glasses, the difference, you know, you take off your glasses and everything's one way, and then it sharpens up when you put your glasses on. It was heightened 20 times that. It was almost as if the color was alive. And so then it started backing up. The color green started backing up until I saw it to be a sprig of a pine tree. And it was almost, I was looking at the pine tree and I didn't feel fear or any kind of thought process. It was more like wonder, the wonder of a child, curiosity. I saw that heightened green of the sprig of pine. I saw the little knotty brown things, you know, that are on a pine tree. And it was almost as if I was in the tree, like I was part of the tree, because I was so close to being able to see it. And the scene continues to back up, back up, back up. And suddenly I'm standing next to the tree. And I look out into the expanse and I see a really blue sky with a white pillowy cloud going by, and I see green grass. And out yonder, there is a group of people in period dress, meaning some clothing I recognized, and other was maybe pioneer clothing, some clothing like what we're wearing today, all different ages of people. It would kind of remind you of maybe a Sunday social or something going on out there, and I'm observing from back here. And then I saw a little girl with really long hair and her hair tied up in ribbons and kind of a Little House on the Prairie kind of dress. And she came through my field of vision and she had like a hula hoop in front of her that she was guiding with a stick as she was going through my field of vision. And I remember smiling at the joy I saw on her face as she was doing that. And then my eyes went back to the crowd and I saw, I keyed in on a man who had his back to me. And for some reason, my eyes started down at the back of his shoes and I'm starting to slowly look up. And as I'm looking up, he's starting to turn around. And at the point my eyes got to his face, he turned around and we were looking eye to eye, and it was my grandfather. Now, my grandfather had died a decade before, and we had been very close. I was the only grandchild for 18 years. I was the apple of his eye. And the thing that was striking, though, is that he was younger than I ever had known him. And my grandfather happened to be orphaned as a young child. He grew up in Boys Town. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's a boys' home. And so there were never any photos taken of him at that younger age. And Boys Town, as it turns out, is not far from where I live. I'll tell you that part of the story later. But anyway, as I look up, but I immediately recognize this as my grandfather. And I started to advance. You know, then I smiled. It's almost like you're at a party, you're hanging back to see if you recognize anybody. And when you do, you know, you're happy and you want to advance. I took that step to advance, and his eyes almost simultaneously telepathically communicated to me that it wasn't my time to come yet. And when I took that step, it was almost as if I had hit plexiglass because I couldn't advance any longer, and then it was over. Mm-hmm. And sometime later, days later, I woke up. Now, people tried to tell me that it was the medication I was on, and they tried to justify a lot of different ways the experience I had. But I have no doubt in my mind that it was a near-death experience, that it wasn't the chemicals or the morphine or the anesthesia or whatever, because I was there. You know, it was real. Now, unlike some people that report these things, I don't consider myself having gone to heaven or wherever, right, however you want to right. describe it. Mm-hmm. What I would, my takeaway over the years is that I was kind of at the porch of the next plane, and that what I call familiars often come and meet you and bring you over to the other side, where it probably looks completely different because we're spiritual beings in a human casing while we're here, my belief. And so I think that's where I was. I was supposed to know that there is, that life continues in a different way, and to not have fear about it. And so that was the end of that, but I will give you an antidote. Years later, I was in Boys Town. I do photography as a hobby, and they've got a couple cool rose gardens there. And I was bending down to get a vantage point of a rose, and I glanced up, and it had been there all along, but I never noticed it. There was a building that said Hall of History. Huh. So I went over and looked at the Hall of History, and they had some very informative things about the history of Boys Town. And then I was drawn to a doorway that said employees only, but I went through that door into a room that had a lot of modern looking card catalog type things, and then some very antique looking ones. And I was drawn, I walked right over, and I went down the letters, and my grandpa's last name started with a D. I went to the D drawer, I opened it up, I flipped through it, and I found a card with my grandpa's name on it. And I had it in my hand, and there was a number of numerical notations on it. And right then a man walked into the room who actually belonged there, an employee, and asked me if he could help me. And I turned around and I handed him the card and I said, "This is my grandpa. What do these numbers mean?" And this was back in 1928, 1929, that time that he was there, right at the beginning. And, you know, the man didn't even question me. He said that they had always had a newspaper. Their community at Boys Town always had Father Flanagan's Weekly Times or whatever it was called. And the notations were every place that my grandfather had been mentioned in a volume of this paper. So the nice man said, "Let's sit down and see, you know, what these are." And he pulled the papers. A couple of them were just notations of him being on a sports team, for example. But as we're flipping through the papers, he flips through a paper that shows a group shot of a basketball team. And it's the whole team. And you know how the ones in back are standing and the ones in front are kind of kneeling? My eyes went right to my grandfather, who was at the end of that picture, at the age I saw him years before in that near-death experience.
Wow.
And no one in the family had ever had a picture of him at that age. So I felt really blessed because he made me copies of those things, and my Nana was still alive, and I was able to put together for her and my mom and her two brothers a packet of information that they had never seen about their father, her husband. And so I thought that was a really cool experience, but it was the same thing. You know, when they talk about the eyes being the window of the soul, that was truly an example of that, because that is exactly where I went in the NDE. And then in that picture, I didn't even have to look at that group of people in the photo. My eyes went right to who I needed to see. So I feel like I was being led and willingly followed each of these cues that happened.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah, that's great. And one of the things there is important for a lot of people. People have the wrong idea, I think, of a coma. They think you're completely brain dead, which is absolutely not the case. I wrote a book a couple of years ago, a year ago, with a woman who'd had a similar sort of experience. The book's called In God's Waiting Room, and we just won a bronze award in a literary competition. But she describes things that happened in her coma that were related to the things that were going on in the hotel, in the hospital room, because her relatives were there because she was about to die. And when I looked at it and saw the story, I saw there was something much more significant going on. She was sort of reliving a spiritual life and reconnecting and making decisions. At one point, Satan appears to her and says, "You know, you're going to be a mess if you live. Come with me." And then the next thing that happens, she almost does the deal and says no. But the next thing that happens is she sees a spiritual figure, an angel, who says, "Your heart will be healed," because she was needing a new heart because of the condition she had, which was H1N1 virus, you know, 10 years ago. "Your heart will be healed and you'll see through different eyes." And a week or so later, she wakes up. She does see through different eyes because she's had a bit of a stroke and her vision is impaired. But amazingly, when the doctor comes to her, the cardiologist said, "Okay, well, now you're out of the coma. We have to see about this heart transplant." And she says, "Well, I know this is kind of strange, but I had this experience with an angel and he told me my heart was healed." So the cardiologist says, "Yeah, well, okay, you know," and sort of placates her. they go and do the procedure, and he comes back and says, I don't believe it. You have a heart of a 20-year-old. And in the book, the doctor says, I can't explain it. It's a, the only way I can explain this is some sort of miracle. And, you know, those things happen a lot more than people imagine. And I think your story is an example of that.
Well, and my mother, a couple days before I came out of the coma and I hadn't spoken, I was off life support at this time and they were just waiting to see when, if I was going to wake up. Out of the blue, I uttered the words, the colors are so bright, when my mom was in the room. Well, I didn't immediately remember that because, you know, when you wake up there's and find out you, you know, your head's shaved and your head's, anyway, I had a lot to process. But when I did remember in pieces what had happened and I told my mother this, the color just kind of drained from her face and then she smiled. She said, I was there. You spoke before you came out of that coma a couple days later, and said, the colors are so bright, exactly what you're saying now.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so there was some amount of even witness to that.
Absolutely.
You know, that someone who hadn't woken up, they didn't even know if I'd be able to talk when I woke up, you know, and still took another couple days, but I said that out loud, you know, when someone was there. But so, yeah, that happened in 95 and I went through that time until I had to leave my career. And at that point, I had gotten married a couple of years, 3 years before, I think. I got married 05 at 5. And that was so I'd remember our anniversary. We made it a date like that. So we had been married for a couple of years, and I was struggling, you know. Unfortunately, so many of us get our confidence and our self-esteem and our self-definition from our career.
Absolutely.
And so when we lose our career, we often lose our sense of self-esteem, our sense of purpose.
Absolutely.
And go through a pretty dark time because you can't go back. That's a time of reckoning where you realize you can't go back to where you were before. And what's in front of you is a dark tunnel. And so you're at a stepping off point that unfortunately a lot of people will make a permanent decision without waiting for the miracle to happen. And so I was sitting there one day and I had journaled back in that year I was recovering. And when I went back to work and wanted to play like I was normal, I put all that stuff away because it was uncomfortable and I just wanted to let it go. And so my mom every year had been saying, you really need to write a book about your experience. You really need to. And I always had some, yeah, you know, maybe someday I'll do that. Maybe someday I'll do that. My desk is too full. I always had an excuse. And so by now I'm married and my husband has heard my mom say that a few times. And I was having a pity party, not knowing exactly what I was going to do. I had a real corner office in an office building, but I also had an office at home. And it always, when I was working, I didn't have a clean desk. I had organized piles all over. I knew exactly where to find things. And every time I cleaned my desk, I couldn't find anything. So my desk was empty now. And I was sitting there one day and my husband said, you know, it's fine that you didn't get back, you know, that you don't go back to work and you explore your options, but, you know, you've been depressed for a while. Maybe you should consider writing that book I always hear your mom talking about. And he motioned into the office and said, your desk is clear now. Well, of course, the first response was getting angry at such a suggestion. It was like throwing the gauntlet down. That was the way I received it. He actually was very nice the way he said it, but it was a challenge. And so I said, all right, I think I will. And I did. I wrote a book about my experience, and that book is called In a Flash, Miracles Here and Beyond. And In a Flash kind of became my handle from then on out, because that's how quickly your life can change. In a flash.
Absolutely. Now, people can find that book where? On Amazon? Or?
They can find it on Amazon, but it's also a lot of other places. What I would say for people to remember is my website is inaflash.org. So inaflash.org. Inaflash.org. And that will tell you everything that we're going to be talking about after that. There's a tab for books, and my books come in ebook, audiobook, and paperback book. And there's a hyperlink that will take you right to Amazon or iTunes or
wherever
to buy the book. So, inaflash.org has the book. And I was blessed to marry a techie. I'm not one. And so he made that website when my book came out. And, you know, at that time, I wasn't a spring chicken at that point. I didn't know a lot about the internet. You know, I had always had, and I don't want to be politically incorrect, especially in this day and age, but I'm just going to say it as I know it. You know, in my job before, I was an executive and I had a secretary, and the computer at that time was our updated IBM Selectric. Mm-hmm. You know, that was her job to learn to use it, not my job. And in that, I'll say that, you know, any executive is only as good as the support staff they have helping them. So it's a compliment by any name or title. You know, the successful person has others that are helping us, you know. But I had no reason to be computer savvy at that time. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't. I was just starting to do email and that kind of thing. And so I didn't know that internet radio existed. I had an old transistor I would flip on at midnight and listen to Coast before I went to bed sometimes. And all of a sudden, you know, one of the differences between, again, I think this wasn't by accident, that had I written that book in 95, 96, 98, instead of it being written at the end of 2011, coming out at the beginning of 2012, is that what happened in that time, one of the things that happened was the advent of the internet. And so all of a sudden I started getting contacted about doing author interviews about my book. Some of them were traditional media outlets I was familiar with, and others were this internet radio thing. And of course, being the sales background I had, the very first man that called me, James Larkin Smith from Texas, was the first podcaster that got a hold of me. And he asked me to do the interview, and I answered, I would love to do it. And I said the appropriate thing. We set it up, and then I got off the phone and went into my husband and said, what's internet radio and how am I going to get on it? And so he fixed me up, and that was my first interview. And as you know, with books, the bloom is on the rose for 9 months to a year, depending on how much you promote. So while I was doing these interviews, unbeknownst to me, there was a radio network, an internet radio network called Brain Injury Radio. And it had been on for 2 years. I'm in Omaha. The founder is in Spokane. He was not as far out from his brain injury, and he had a very bad car accident and suffered a TBI. And he's a little younger than me, so he found the mechanism. On every Monday for 2 years, he was doing a show on Brain Injury Radio, is what he called it. And he was processing, I think, a lot of the things I had been processing alone for all those years, because we didn't have support groups. And I went to a lot of kinds of doctors, and none of them really had a full understanding of the residuals that you carry down the road after you've had a head injury. And unfortunately, a lot of them still don't. Yep. You know, they have about a page in their medical textbook that addresses it. And so that's disappointing. Between 95 and 2020, they have come a ways, but not near as far as I would have hoped, you know, and thought that they would come. But in any case, Craig had been doing his show for 2 years. So while I'm writing my book, not knowing he exists, he decided that what he found out is that the need was so great for a support mechanism, a peer-to-peer support mechanism for people with brain injury, that he wanted to have the network go 7 nights a week. And he's thinking this idea while I'm writing my book and getting it out. And he happened to catch one of my interviews somewhere. And he got a hold of me and he said, he told me the deal. And he said, I wondered if you wanted to be one of the original 7 hosts. And I said, well, thank you so much. I said, but I don't know the computer that well. I don't know really anything about brain injury except my story. And I have no background in broadcasting, so thank you, but I'm not your gal. Mm-hmm. And he said, were you an author before you wrote your book? And I said, no. And he said, and you do have a brain injury? And I said, yes. And he said, you're qualified. He said, what night do you want? And I just said, how about Wednesday? Okay, I don't know what's going on here. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I guess I thought, well, I'm not doing anything else right now, kind of like the circumstances that came up with the book. The bloom was going to come off the book and I was going to be back where I was the year before I wrote it, right? That gave me a boost to write that book and have some purpose in doing that. But then where was I going to be, right? So I thought, well, the worst that can happen, you know, the radio show streams to all 50 states, 49 countries, goes from live to archive. The worst that can happen is I can make a complete and total ass out of myself once, and then I'll move on, you know, and do something else. And 8.5 years later, I'm still a host on every Wednesday night on Brain Injury Radio Network. And what I can say is that that not only gave me my sense of purpose back, and a way to communicate with others who had been through the same thing, because you find yourself, you know, people don't believe what they can't see. If you're a sympathetic character and you were injured in a way that impedes your speech or you can't walk or whatever, you're the sympathetic character and people believe you. But if you tell people, if you try to explain neuro fatigue or or chronic headaches or full basket syndrome, focus, try to explain this to people. They either think you're making an excuse and don't believe you, or they minimize and they say, oh, I get tired, or oh, I get headaches. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they have no idea, because they haven't walked in those shoes.
Correct.
And it doesn't often suit their agenda, perhaps, for what they want out of you. And so to be able to be hooked up with, oh my God, you know, I started listening to some of his shows, and it was like I got caught. I remember hearing Craig say, I live in a world of post-it notes. And I just jumped. I felt like a kid that got caught with her hand in the cookie jar, because that's what I had been doing. And then I'd forget where I put the post-it note that I needed. And here were all these people calling into his show, and they were telling my story, you know, in
English. Yeah.
And so that became me, you know, on Wednesday night. I learned more in the last 8.5 years about brain injury and myself and my own circumstance than I had in the 17 years prior from the incident happening, relying on the traditional medical model and by myself. Anyway, more in 8 years than in the 17 years prior. And I've been really blessed to, you know, it's funny, it took me a while to process this, but I had thought when I left my career that my skill set had gotten burnt. Mm-hmm. Come to think of it, and it took me a while of doing shows, that my skill set didn't get burnt. It got redirected, and I hadn't realized it, because one of the things I do is talk to people like yourself. I've had some famous NFL players and their attorneys. I'm a very strong patriot. I have a lot of veterans on my show. People who talk about alternative types of treatment outside of pharma. I don't have pharma on my show, which is not to say that some people don't need medication, but that is the first line of defense now, is pill pelting.
Yep.
I found in our community, bottom line is that doesn't solve the problem, and it often gives more problem. And so there's some other things that need to be done. So I'll have people that have different types of treatment that come on the show. And so that networking, not only with my audience, but with my guests, that was part of my skill set in sales.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Was networking.
Absolutely.
And then communicating verbally, talking and explaining to people or asking them questions to ferret out the problem and then look at the solutions, be solutions oriented,
right.
Identify the problem. And what I say in my show is that it's focused on the four A's of recovery. Awareness, short-term memory. Awareness, action, and adaptation are three of them. I'm sorry, I should have brought my notes with me, but I say it at the beginning of all. Yes, awareness, acceptance, action, and adaptation. Thank you. That happens a lot. And the other thing, I'm very blessed, it's brain injury radio. Those kind of things are forgiven.
Oh, of course. They're forgiven here too. Yeah, no, that's okay. And that's awesome, because I think you're right. Your skills have been redirected and combined with a passion and a purpose. And now you are helping and have been for the last almost a decade helping people. And I think you are seeing, you know, what the show in some ways is really meant to be about. Other way, you know, breaking down the sort of stereotypes and misinformation there is about all sorts of different types of injuries, including brain injury. You know, I'm sure people have misconceptions about how much they can recover, you know, what potentials they have. I mean, I'm sure some of those things come up in the work that you've done on the show, right?
Yes, a couple things I'd like to impart there is, first of all, you know, everybody has heard of cancer, heart disease, stroke. People don't know a lot about brain injury. And 2.5 million brain injuries happen a year. And that's a lot, you know, and because it's misunderstood, it's often misdiagnosed, as I was an example of, or underdiagnosed. Yeah. And so the raw number of the 2.5 million that you find on different websites is undoubtedly low. And so one of the things that we try to talk about, now I want to preface Craig with saying, when he called it Brain Injury Radio instead of TBI show or ABI show or stroke show or whatever, he really, I think, also had some divine intervention, because he was a car accident TBI. And when we had our very first meeting of the first 7 hosts, they were all TBIs. Now, for the audience, I'll tell you the difference between a TBI and an ABI. A TBI is something that comes from the outside. Your head gets hit from the outside, in a car accident, domestic violence a lot of times, or assault. Certainly in sports, you know, you get a direct hit from the outside. An ABI originates inside the brain, and that would be something like a ruptured brain aneurysm, a stroke, an AVM, a number of different things that originate from the inside. Now, when we met and had our first meeting, they were all TBIs and they were guys. And when they found out, we were all introducing ourselves and saying a couple sentences. And there is kind of a smart aleck who, incidentally, isn't with us anymore. When I became the director of operations for our network, he said to Craig, "What's she doing here? She doesn't belong here. She's an ABI." Well, you know, at that point, 17 years out, I didn't even know what an ABI was. You know, I had a brain aneurysm. I thought I'd been called worse, but what the heck's an ABI? And Craig said to him, "She's staying and you should listen and learn." And at this point, he had no idea of whether I was going to work out or whatever. But I think the good, the wonderful thing that he did is that, you know, there's different organizations. There's a brain injury association, a brain injury, I'm trying to think of the other name they give themselves. If they're not an association, they're something else. But each group, aneurysm has a foundation, okay? Brain aneurysm foundation. Each group for each brain injury has about 2 different advocacy groups that are out there. And they're wonderful when you're doing a show and you want to look up statistics for any of those things.
Right. Yeah.
But if you're a survivor and you're calling and saying, "What can you do to help me? I can't find doctors or anybody that understands," they don't have much. The top 2, and I've had them all on my show, by the way, and they're nice people, but the top 2 in the board of directors get a very nice salary. And once a year, they all have a walk, right? You've got your pink month and your green month and your stroke month and your this month. So there's always a walk and a cheap t-shirt for each one of these organizations. And the question I've learned to ask now is, how many survivors do you have on your board of directors? Because you're advocating for us. So you need to have people on your board of directors who know about us. So again, what I liked about Craig's approach is that we're an all-inclusive brain injury support network. All of our hosts, 7 nights a week, are people who have survived some kind of brain injury. Mm-hmm. We all have a different approach to how we do our shows. We all have a different personality. We all had a different experience. But for people who don't have real life, I don't say or discourage people. I encourage them. If they live in a place that has face-to-face support group, that's a really good idea. But a lot of people who have brain injury can't drive anymore. Maybe they live in a rural area. Yeah. Maybe like me, all these years later, there's still no support group here in mm-hmm. town. Mm-hmm. That this was a very viable peer-to-peer support mechanism for people all over the world, 7 nights a week. If you don't like me, tune in on another night. I do tell people to give any given host a chance or two, because mm-hmm. we all have our on nights and our off nights. You know, don't judge a person by one time. You know, give them a couple times. But if you wind up not liking them, switch to another night. The important thing is that you get the help and the support to know you're not alone, you're not unique, that there are others of us out here that are advocating and doing the best we can. And we're getting back more, I think, as hosts than we're trying our darndest to impart on our listeners and our audience. And it seems to work out really well. So a lot of that misunderstanding, now we're all learning from each other. And one of the things that we're doing, I've done it with my couple of my doctors, and others have done it too, is they've actually taken notes or taken the links to the show and brought it to their doctor mm-hmm. and had their doctor listen. Now, obviously, the doctor may care to listen, may not, but it's somebody bringing a resource to them. Them not having to look too hard to find an answer. And I'm fortunate in my case, my shrink, for one, has been super open mm-hmm. to hearing everything that I bring. And my couple other people that are in my medical circle, I guess, listen to my shows and have learned quite a bit from listening, and now are better able to relate right. and to be honest about what they can do and what they can't do to the patient.
Yep.
And So that's been a really wonderful experience.
Yeah, and really that's a huge role and an important one to play. I think you're right. You know, a lot of organizations get started and they want to help, but they have a particular lens, and then the organization itself becomes more important, and then you become very, very siloed in what you do. And one of the things that I really like about what you guys are doing is this is about brain injury generally. And so that people can listen, they can understand perhaps differences, they can relate. I personally believe that sort of group dynamics, the sort of thing you're trying to convey on internet radio, are fundamental to recovery and health. I mean, you've got support. So many people, as you rightly say, feel they're the only ones. And if you suddenly see, oh my gosh, this person that knows what I'm feeling, you know, there's somebody else out there that I can relate to. Very important. Then you get the stories that can be inspirational. Then you get the advice that can be informational. And yes. then you get the hope that, you know, and so forth. So what you're doing is very, very, very important. And on that score, if listeners are interested in finding out more about Brain Injury Radio, what do they have to do? Where do they go?
Well, braininjuryradio.com has all of our shows. And when you go to braininjuryradio.com, it shows upcoming shows and it shows the on-demand shows. And then again, on myinaflash.org are just my shows under the show tab. But for everybody, braininjuryradio.com. And there's a Facebook page, Brain Injury Radio, where you can look and see what show's going to be on tonight, kind of a thing. And yeah, it works out really great. And hope, I think, is a real key to what you said, a message of hope. But, you know, another observation we found out is that it seems like a couple things happened to me. And it turns out they happen to a lot of other people that have been through this process. And one of them is, if you were artistic before, which I wasn't, but if you were artistic before, it seems that with a lot of people, they wind up being even more so and branching out into areas of art that they hadn't gotten into before. And for people like me, who I tell this joke about Bunny Smith, my second grade teacher, we were drawing, you know, you had to take art, and I was expected to get good grades from early on all the way up. And this damn art class, we were drawing something, and Bunny looked over my shoulder and patted me on the shoulder and said, "It's okay, honey. Not everybody can be artistic." Now, every teacher I've told that, or therapist, has been horrified, you know, that I carried that mantle, you know, into my adult life, way into my adult life. And we did a show on it one night, because I was noticing a lot of people were talking about this art stuff that they had gotten into. And, you know, one thing is, the definition of art for me was too narrow, because I thought art meant you can freehand draw a horse, you know.
Yeah, you can paint the Mona Lisa, right?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Exactly. And so, you know, I didn't think that doing a radio show or writing books or being a photographer, that all of these things are mechanisms of art. And so on Facebook, there is a page called Disability Art Page. And we invited people, after having enough of these shows and hearing this come back over and over and over again, about people's artistic prowess, whether it was adult coloring, music, wood carving, how broad that area of art really is. And people were timid about showing their art, or like me, not even recognizing that what they were doing was art. And all of those things help empower us, you know, a step at a time, you know, building blocks to empowerment and actualization. And so we started a disability art page on Facebook, and it's been great. It's for survivors. Disability, we made it disability art page in general, so you don't just have to have a head injury. We don't want people, you know, advertising, selling. What this was a safe space, is the word they're using today, where survivors could go and put up some of their artwork and feel safe and not be criticized, and get encouragement for doing what they're doing, and to help everybody broaden that definition of art and to feel good about what they're creating. And again, those are all just building blocks. All of what we lost doesn't come back in a day. It's a process.
Right. Or come back in the same way. You know, as you're telling your story, I'm interested in the fact that, you know, here in this coma, you have an experience of that is around the concept of color. And then your eyes meet your grandfather's eyes. And that seemed very visual. So then I'm thinking, oh, no wonder she's good at photography. You know, that, you know, it's, that makes perfect sense to me, you know, light, that whole visual thing makes perfect sense to me, that you would find some creative outlet, if you want to call it that, in your photography. Yeah.
Well, and the funny thing about that too is one of the other residuals from my brain is that my vision isn't good. I have floaters that make it look like I'm looking through a dirty window. And so it's odd that that kind of art would come to me. One other thing is a kind of intuitiveness that people didn't have before, a sensitivity that they didn't have before. I'll talk about that in a minute if we have time. But, you know, it's with that I do my photography and my other art. And going back to my grandpa again for just a minute, when I was little, he used to take me fishing. He's the only man who ever did or ever will get me up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go fishing. But he would want to put a bobber on my fishing pole. And I didn't want that. For some reason, I felt like that was cheating. And so I didn't want a bobber. And I didn't know this because I was 4, 5, 6 years old when we were doing this. But when I fished, I was almost one with my fishing line. And could feel that slight tug and then react and catch that fish. And with the photography, it's almost that same dynamic. When I look at something from whatever perspective I'm looking at it that I want to capture, I'm looking at it and I'm taking that photo and I'm not necessarily seeing that clearly and crisply when I'm taking it, but it comes out that way. The vantage point and the angles and the perspective, you know, that I put in it supersedes my actual visual acuity, which is really pretty cool. I hope that continues to last. I mean, as I'm aging, we all have concerns about that, but it's been pretty cool to experience the art, you know, through some intuitive and other ways than you might think. So if you do have issues that you think are going to keep you from doing something, what I always say is there isn't any failure. If there is, it's in not trying, because there is no judgment. You try anything you want to try. And another thing we've been groomed to do, just like defining ourselves by our job, is by how good we are at something.
Yep.
And we've got to throw some old ideas out the window. The empowerment is in the trying and the doing. Absolutely. No matter what the outcome is, the empowerment is that I went beyond thinking it and took the action to do it. So I encourage people to try anything that's on their bucket list. And if they like it, great. If they don't like it, go to the next thing. But the important thing is that while we're here, we have the opportunity. And I hate to see anybody miss the opportunity.
Yeah, and the other thing, of course, is what we now know is the brain is incredibly adaptive and changes. And so it allows you to do things, but perhaps in a slightly different way. It might be, quotation mark, a better way or what have you, but it allows you to do that, which is phenomenally exciting, really. And we know that the brain changes as you do things. You have to act, the brain changes and adapts to what you do. And so it is incredible the things that people can do when they, you know, just accept, hey, I'm going to try. I don't have to paint the Mona Lisa. I'm just going to do it and proceed from there, sort of like you did. So that is, you know, your story is a wonderful story, Kim, of great hope. And I'm sure you're inspirational on your radio show and have helped lots of people. So long may that continue. Again, that's braininjuryradio.com and inaflash.org, right? If people want to reach you specifically.
Yes. Can I say one more thing real
quick? Of course.
For nature lovers, my second book, which just came out in October, totally different genre. It's also on the Inaflash under books, is called Hootie's Hollow and the Magic Tree. This was also interesting because it came out December 1st of 2019, just this last year. And of course, the pandemic and everything hadn't happened. And what happened 2 years ago is I'm a real animal lover, and we had four dogs at the time and a bird, and one of them was a little wiener dog named Mario, and I had had him, he even predated my marriage, back to my very first house. And Mario was a little old man now, and we had been at our current house, and we have a big old oak tree out there, and Mario was aging. You know, I knew his days were probably numbered, but he would walk really slow out to this tree and lie down at the base of the tree. And I'd see him just sitting and observing, probably reflecting, and the wind blow and his ears blow. And when Mario passed away, of course, that was really emotional for me. And when he passed away, 2 months later, you know, I was really used to looking out for Mario under the tree, get in that habit. And of course, he wasn't there. But one day I looked out and some motion caught my peripheral. And I looked up, and on the same side of the tree, but up, I don't know, 20 feet maybe, there was, I would call it a hole or a notch back then, but what it was, another name for it, is a hollow. Mm-hmm. I looked up and there was a little owl in that hollow. And I had never seen a little owl. Now, with my other three dogs, had that been any other kind of owl, like a big owl who could have picked up one of my dogs and done damage to my pack, I would have had to do something to get rid of it. But it happened to be a tiny eastern screech owl. They're very little. Mm-hmm. Hootie wound up staying, and we communicated, oddly now that you say this back in reflection, but through our eyes. This was a new subject right in my own backyard that I must have taken 10 zillion pictures of Hootie. And had Hootie's routine down. I'd rock back and forth. Hootie would rock back and forth. And we had this bond and relationship going. And it was ironic that Mario had just died. And in Native American lore, an owl can come through the veil of the living and the other side. And I saw Hootie as being a messenger on a lot of different levels. But anyway, Hootie stayed for a few months. And there are some other things that went on in my own backyard. So when you think of simple pleasures and that joy doesn't have to be derived from an adrenaline rush, sometimes you redefine what makes you happy, and it's in your own backyard, Dorothy, is that Hootie wound up going away in the summer. He came in the fall, he left in the summer, and some things happened over that summer. And the next fall, I looked up and Hootie came back and stayed. And so I wound up writing a book called Hootie's Hollow and the Magic Tree. And there I talk about animals that you just walk by and usually ignore in your own backyard. I do talk about the messages inherent in Hootie, but I also talk about the animals, the squirrels, the robins coming out. It's spring. And the lessons each of those animals impart that are mirrored in human beings. And it's a very fun story. And I took photographs. So as every character is getting introduced, there's a photograph of the character. So, and the cover, Hootie is a picture of Hootie that I took, is on the cover of that book. And it's short, it's fun, it's entertaining and enlightening. And it's funny that, you know, I would have written it when I did, and just a couple months later, we're in a quarantine situation. There's a lot of people out there that can't entertain themselves, that are going nuts because they can't get out. And it makes that book even more cool to read because it all takes place in my backyard things that are happening. So anyway, decided to jump out and try something new on that. And even on the audio book, you can download a PDF of the photos on it. But it's a fun book too. And so, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for telling us about that. We should definitely look it up. And you're right. We miss so many things, the small things that are right in front of our eyes, because we're too busy on a to-do list or what we think is more important, and we forget the important things that are right in front of us. And, you know, I think that's a great reflection of who you are, of reflecting the importance of the things around us and not having to get really, really complex. You can look at the simple things and find meaning there. So, Kim, thank you so much for sharing your story, being on the show. I really appreciate it. I've enjoyed it a lot. And God bless you, and keep doing the great work.
Thank you, Dr. Rankin, and God bless you. Thanks, everybody.